Welcome to the Movies on the Brain podcast. I am one of your hosts, Ryan C. Wood. Chad Metz, who is generally my co-host on these podcasts, is preoccupied for this particular episode, and I decided that we would take this opportunity to kind of wind back the clock and go back to the way this podcast started, at least for an episode. We will be back later on this weekend after D23 is over with a with our usual episode. Chad will be here, and we will be discussing all kinds of weird, wild, and wacky week in the world of genre and movie news, and covering D23 and the previewing Comic-Con and talking about what's to come and the news of the week. So that'll be posted later on in the week. But I wanted to take this opportunity as we get closer and closer to our 100th podcast to kind of wind back the clock and go back and really just do an episode of the same way that this podcast started in May of 2015, which is me sitting in a room talking about a movie. And in this particular case, I want to talk tonight about War for the Planet of the Apes. So let's dive in, because this is a very deep, very complex, very nuanced movie. So I am not one who's given to hyperbole unless I'm, you know, going on a rant about Ghostbusters or Power Rangers or Jumanji or something. I try to be very practical with my film criticism. I'm not a professional, but I see enough films every year that I have a pretty good idea of what I'm looking for. And I understand about craftsmanship and cinematography and editing and costume design and set decoration and, you know, screenplay and all of those kinds of technical aspects that go into creating a film. And so I have a pretty good idea of how to evaluate a film and a good way to look at things. And so I'm generally not an overly critical person, but there are definitely good movies, and there are definitely those that have their flaws and their issues, and even some of the best movies have issues. That being said, I'm not given to hyperbole. I'm not given to the being a prisoner of the moment and talking like about how this is the greatest thing ever and everybody must see it because, you know, that's the conversation on Twitter, or we're just, you know, so ADD that we're preoccupied with what's right in front of us. I know conversations get had on other podcasts about the idea of teaser culture and perpetually moving on to and promoting the next things and losing track of what's coming up directly or what is here in front of us. And I'm not really keen on being given into that kind of talk or rhetoric or hyperbole. But to me, the Planet of the Apes franchise, these three films, Rise, Dawn, and War of the Planet of the Apes, are the greatest cinematic trilogy of the 21st century. And that is over and above the Toy Story trilogy. It's over and above the Dark Knight trilogy. That's over and above the Concerto trilogy. These three films are masterworks of dramatic storytelling. We got on a conversation to open our podcast last week about the conversation regarding popcorn movies and tentpole movies just being, you know, for lack of a better term, irrelevant. That they don't really have anything to offer, that they don't really have anything to say. They're just there for public enjoyment to kind of put butts in seats and make money. And there are definitely franchises, and there are definitely filmmakers and definitely films where you can make a legitimate argument that that's simply the case. The Transformers franchise is one that we derive here on this podcast on a regular basis as an example of a franchise that is literally dying in the United States, but is only being kept alive because, you know, China. And they're not really concerned about quality. They're not really concerned about dialogue. They're not really concerned about story or plot. They're just trying to put something together that's going to draw attention overseas. So, yes, there are definitely arguments to be made about certain franchises, certain filmmakers, and their ability to put together complex, nuanced tentpoles. But the fact of the matter is that those complex, nuanced tentpoles can exist, and Apes is one of them. I will make the contention that if you release the Planet of the Apes movies in October, they still would make just as much money as they would in July, and their critical response would be just as superb. Because the movies themselves are terrific. The nuance of the storytelling, the thematic relevance of the story, the character development, the world building that is done, the nods to the original trilogy without hammering home the original films, without hammering home or making current audience members feel like they're out of place, is remarkable. What Rupert Wyatt and Matt Reeves have done with these three films, as well as Andy Serkis and the folks over at Weta, is truly raise the bar for what blockbuster tentpole filmmaking can be. So let's get into some of the reasons why I believe that this film and this trilogy are some of the best to ever come out so far over the course of the last 17 years. So let's start off with the history of the Planet of the Apes franchise. Everybody knows that Charlton Heston made a movie back in the late 60s, early 70s, called Planet of the Apes. It produced one of the most iconic images in the history of film. Heston kneeling in front of the Statue of Liberty, covered up in sand, and, you know, his line about those damn dirty apes. And, you know, having his moment of realization that the planet Earth has been overtaken by apes. And so everybody knows that story, and everybody knows that that film got made. But the thing about the Apes franchise is that those early movies in the 70s, late 70s and early 80s, while they didn't make a lot of money, and while they didn't have a ginormously huge budget, even for the time, they were movies that were born out of the post-Vietnam War and Watergate eras. They were movies that were reflections upon such heavy dramatic themes as racial relations, as communism versus... they commented on the dynamic between communism and democracy. They commented on slavery. They had a whole lot of subtext. Later films in the franchise would, especially Beneath the Planet of the Apes, would tackle issues of nuclear war. These are very deep, heavy themes. And the latter films in the Apes franchise in the late 70s, early 80s were given more toward camp, but they were still holding to these ideas of promoting these themes and having something to say about the world around them in the current day. And it is, you know, Heston's performance in the first movie is kind of transcendent in a way. It's great sci-fi. He is such a dynamic, charismatic personality that he carries the weight of the astronaut role well. He is POV for a lot of the film for the viewer, and his reactions are very realistic and authentic, and he lends an authenticity to that role that I don't think very many other actors of the time would have been able to pull off. The creature design of the time, the costumes and the makeup and the visual effects work that was being done on those eight movies was groundbreaking for the late 70s, early 80s. And so that's another reason why those films remained relevant, especially the first two, remained relevant as time went on. But, as all franchises do, things wore out after a while. the budgets began to decrease, the ticket revenues began to decrease, and, you know, as a result, eventually they stopped being profitable for the studio to make, and so eventually we stopped getting Apes films. And then Tim Burton decided that he wanted to enter the 21st century and he wanted to do a Planet of the Apes movie. Now, Burton, while he's an eccentric filmmaker with a unique proclivity toward wacky and weird, he was at the time a solid filmmaker with a string of successful movies behind his name that made it plausible that he could bring the Planet of the Apes franchise back into relevance in the late 90s, early 2000s. One of his biggest assets as a filmmaker is his eye and his interpretation in his creature design, in the way that he does prosthetics, in the way that he does costumes, in the way that he does visual effects. You can see a lot of that in Edward Scissorhands. You can see it a lot in Sleepy Hollow. You can see it a lot in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. You can see a lot of it in Dark Shadows. He has a very particular aesthetic, and he has a very particular way with character design. And so that was a great thing that he brought to the Apes franchise. He brought a new creative idea of depicting the apes and the way that the apes would look and interact with their human counterparts. The problem was that he cast Mark Wahlberg as the lead actor, who did not at the time really have the charisma or the persona that Charlton Heston had to carry a movie such as this. And also the plot and the storytelling, as is the case with most Burton films, has issues. And the movie got very poorly received by critics. And as a result, it also got poorly received by audience members. And so when, as is normally the case in Hollywood, when you make you take a beloved property, an intellectual property, and you make a movie, and the movie does not turn out successful, you shut the production. You tend to shelter the property for a little while. And such was the state of the Planet of the Apes franchise. They were kind of in cryostasis for a while. Andy Serkis, who is a mastermind, he is a genius, he is an acting legend, who is pioneering, he helped pioneer a new technique called motion capture, working with Peter Jackson on the Lord of the Rings films to bring the character of Gollum to life. And the producers of the Planet of the Apes, some producers over at 20th Century Fox, who knew that this franchise was there, this IP was there, and had all kinds of potential for relevancy. But they knew also that if they were going to do it, they couldn't do Apes the way that they were done in the original series and in the way that they were done in the Burton movies with normal prosthetics. That the brand had been tarnished to an extent and became sort of cultish in its following. And so the belief among the producers was that you needed to offer something fresh, something new, something bold, something different. And to be quite honest, it was going to take a bold and different approach to get the financing you were going to need to make this movie. And so the idea that they came up with working with Andy Serkis was to basically work with the people over at Weta and to create the apes digitally. That you would have, especially in the first film, human cast members, but that the apes themselves would be computer-generated CGI characters done in the motion capture with the motion capture technology that had been rendered to do Gollum to great effect. And the idea was that Serkis would play the lead character known as Caesar. They hired Rupert Wyatt to direct this movie, and they Got James Franco and John Lithgow to sign on. And Rise of the Planet of the Apes began. And Apes, Rise of the Planet of the Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I get confused because Dawn should have been the title of the first movie. Rise of the Planet of the Apes is basically a revolution story. The whole foundation for Caesar's perception of humanity, the whole basis for who he is as an ape and what his thought processes are and what his emotions are and feelings are toward humans are completely based in his origins, which are in Rise of the Planet of the Apes. The compassion and the love and the honesty and the earnestness that John Lithgow's character and James Franco's character display towards Caesar in Rise of the Planet of the Apes helps to form him. It helps to create the basis for his learning and his identity, the way it is for any child. When you are a child, you look up to your parents, and in some way, you are molded by the kind of parents that you have and the whole nature versus nurture argument. And you have an opportunity there to help shape, they help shape you for your early days. And so such was the case with Caesar. And really what the story of Rise of the Planet of the Apes is a revolution story. Man is being arrogant. Man is trying to use scientific technology, and part of the testing process for new drugs that could potentially cure Alzheimer's or cure cancer. And the way that those drugs are tested is either through clinical trials on humans, which are, you have to get through a certain stage to get there. And before you get to human testing, you have to get to animal testing. And, you know, the idea of Caesar being a rescue ape, essentially, rescued from his from the testing lab and rescued from his mother, who was dying, who was killed as a result of a program being terminated. And Franco's character bringing him home, and his elderly father, who is dying of Alzheimer's, taking him in and really raising him in a home, and him growing up and learning and knowing human interaction and human love. The problem is that when Caesar basically makes a mistake and gets found out, you know, he has to be impounded. And, you know, Franco's character tries his best. He's really torn emotionally with the decision, but Franco's character ultimately has to let Caesar go. And Caesar, when he's in the habitat with the apes who will come to be his closest companions in the years going forward, has to find a new home. He has to find a home within the ape community. He has to figure out his identity of who he is as an ape. And of course, you have the whole plot of the Nero gas and the neurotoxin and, you know, the virus and the doctor becoming infected and becoming patient zero and the neurotoxin making the apes strong and the apes escaping from the lab and going out into the community and running and escaping San Francisco and heading to the Redwood Forest and going amongst the trees and Caesar leading the apes and coming up with the mantra of ape together strong. And of course, also Koba, who, to be quite honest, Caesar rescues from his captivity. And Koba, you know, when confronted with the scientists who were torturing him, Caesar allows him to kill allows him to push the helicopter of the leader of the scientific testing group off the San Francisco Bridge, killing him. And as I said, the apes end up going into the forest, and you know, that's the end of Rise of the Planet of the Apes. The disease, the virus that will ultimately wipe out the human civilization is now out there with Patient Zero, and it slowly but surely infects and kills many, many, many millions of people. And that's where we find our characters at the beginning of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And if Rise of the Planet of the Apes is a revolution film about Caesar coming into his own, figuring out who he is, and leading the revolution of the apes out of the captivity and delivering them to the promised land of the Redwood Forest, the plot and the idea and the theme of Rise of the Planet of the Apes is, or Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, is essentially a coup. It is the story of an evolving society, a dueling of the fates, if you want to use the term, from Star Wars. The dueling of the fates in this film are basically two humans and two apes. The two humans played by Jason Clarke and Gary Oldman, and the two apes played by Andy Serkis and Toby Gillery, who plays Koba. So Caesar and Koba. And the dichotomy here is basically that when we pick up with Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, the apes have not seen man for about 3 years. They're beginning to wonder whether or not mankind has completely evaporated from the Earth. And when Jason Clarke and his little band of scragglers, survivors of the virus, trying to set up their own little community not too far from the ape compound, they need the dam that is nearby to become functional so that they can have enough electricity to kind of function. And basically what we get is the core dynamic and the core conflict of the film, which is two men and two apes with two different philosophies about each other. So Gary Oldman and Jason Clarke differ as far as the approach to the apes and how to deal with the apes. You know, Clarke is just trying to make enough peace so that they can get the dam built and be on their merry little way. And Caesar agrees. Caesar takes pity and has a sadness toward the humans that you know, he wants to see them to at least have enough ability to survive. And he's informed by, as I said, his upbringing, his raising, his maturity, you know, the way that he was taught by Franco to love humanity and the compassion that he would have toward humans for his life. And the same thing happens with Koba. Koba is informed by his lifetime of being a lab ape, his lifetime of being a science experiment, of being cut upon and scarred and hit and tortured. And so the two men have two very different ideas of how to deal with man. Caesar's very much the possibility of the mindset that these are just a few humans. Let them go off. Let them get their electricity and go back to their little community and raise themselves and their families in the best way possible. Have compassion and mercy upon them. Koba is much more of the mindset that, look, they're going to get guns. And they probably, you know what, they probably already have guns. And you know what they're going to do? They're going to get guns, and they're going to come to us, and they're going to try and kill us, because they still hate us. Because they cannot deal with the fact that we are bigger than them, that we are stronger than them, that ape is now superior to man. They cannot stand that. And man is inherently bad and inherently evil, and therefore, man will ultimately try and kill ape again. So we need to wipe these guys out. We don't need to help them. We need to wipe them out, men, women, children, all of them, and start from scratch. And Koba is an effective enough leader that he essentially has his own little sect of apes who agree with him. And so the plot of Rise of the Planet of the Apes is basically, you know, Koba deciding that because Caesar is quote-unquote soft on humans, that he is not fit to lead the tribe, and therefore Caesar tries to mount a coup. And he is very effective in his attempt to carry out a coup. The only problem is he doesn't finish the job. He doesn't kill Caesar. And he thinks he does, but he doesn't finish the job. He doesn't kill Caesar. Caesar is found and rescued by Jason Clark. He is nursed back to health, and just in time, because as he's fully healthy, Koba is taking the apes, of the majority of the apes, and going to the human settlement to try and make an attack on the humans. And what happens in the town is that the apes and the human resistance forces led by Gary Oldman and Caesar and Jason Clark are trying to get to the city, and ultimately what we have is a clash between apes and humans and apes and apes that results ultimately in a big set piece that revolves around a long drawn out battle between Koba and Caesar, which is one of the most compelling, riveting, emotional fights you will ever see in a movie, whether it be a comic book movie, whether it be a serious drama, because you have invested in these characters, because you've seen them through two movies, and you've seen them grow and mature, and honestly, you can see both sides of their opinions on matters. And, ultimately, most of the audience ends up rooting for Caesar, who ultimately triumphs and makes the decision to throw Koba off the tower to his death. He does die. Caesar becomes leader of the whole of the apes. And Koba's faction runs off and hides. And Caesar comes to Gary Oldman and as he's dying and finds out that when the apes came to attack them, that Gary Oldman sent out a distress call and the reinforcements and warships were on the way. And Koba hangs his head and realizes that while ape did not start war, he did not start war, he's going to have to fight the war. And so he leads his apes over to the Golden Gate Bridge. He looks out, he sees the warships coming, and his weariness, because he knows that he is now going to have to fight somebody else's fight. And ultimately, in Caesar's view, Koba was fundamentally flawed in his ability not to be able to overcome his hate. Humans have done bad things to Caesar. Caesar was treated horribly by Dean DeHaan in the animal care facility in the first movie. He was treated very wrongly by the humans who discovered him while he was in James Franco's character's care. And even Franco was kind of harsh toward him at different points. Humans have been hard and bad and difficult to Caesar. But the thing about it is, Caesar never allowed that hate to consume him. He came again from a place of love and caring for humans, so he tended to be more lenient and see the good in humans. Again, Koba saw only the bad, and he could never overcome that, and that was ultimately his fatal flaw. And that leads us to War for the Planet of the Apes. So let's dive in here to why I believe this movie is really excellent and really worth your time, and something that you really need to see. First of all, everything that I've spent the last 20 or 30 minutes talking about is basically distilled down to a paragraph or a few sentences at the beginning of the film. So not only do you get, if you've never seen an apes movie, any of the previous two movies, the plot of those two, which I just took 30 minutes to explain here, is distilled into a paragraph format that's easy to explain, which perfectly sets up where we are in this world as we enter it. As I said, this film, the three films as a whole, cover 14 years. And the War for the Planet of the Apes begins 14 years after Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and it occurs a number of years, 3 years or 4 years, after the events of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. The war has been raging for a while. And one of the things that we get very clear is that we have actual Marines. We have actual military-trained people, the last of which are still alive, fighting this war against the apes. And what we see when we begin the film is a guerrilla war scene or a fight in the forest that is very reminiscent of, you know, whether you want to say the Battle of Endor, whether you want to say the battles of Vietnam, it has echoes of both. And what we see when the first time we see Caesar is the colonel's human troops have tried to make an advance on a military compound, or a gathering of apes, a compound of apes. And they go to take it out. They attempt to ambush the apes. The apes call for backup. Caesar and his crew come. They eventually outman and overpower the humans, even though the humans have guns, because the apes have guns too. And they tactically outmaneuver the humans. They capture a few of the human leaders. And to be quite honest, what most people of Koba's mindset, people who are hostile and resentful and bitter toward humans, what they would do is typically kill these prisoners and send them back, these captives, and send them back, their bodies back, to their respective leader as a signal or as a message. And what we get instead with Caesar when we first see him in this movie is a sense of what a toll this war has taken upon him. The CGI and the motion capture have advanced greatly from Rise to Dawn and from Dawn to War. It is just a completely different level. Looking at Caesar now looks like what you would imagine looking into the face of Charlton Heston's Moses. His hair is, he has more lines on his wrinkles in his forehead. He has more gray in his hair. His posture is more slumped. He truly looks like a war-weary leader. And he tends to the ape who they have captured. We find out that basically Koba's clique, his tribe, his sect of apes who were aligned with him, as I said, at the end of Dawn, ran for fear of Caesar and Caesar's retribution upon them, although Caesar would probably have been more than likely willing to impart pardon them and give them mercy. They didn't want to take a chance, so they ran to the humans to become what are referred to as donkeys, which is essentially what you would think, pack mule. They carry weapons, they carry ammunition, they load weapons and ammunition for their human counterparts in the fight against the apes. And he addresses the ape and addresses that faction of Caesar, of Koba's that has left. And he addresses the situation at present. And he ultimately sends the human captives back to the colonel with a message. Leave us the forest. A deal, a peace deal. Leave us the forest, and this killing can stop. And what follows that is they put them on the prisoners on the donkey, send them back with that message. They try to they take the ape who has been captured from the donkey that was a member of Caesar of Koba's clique. They take him out back to try and hurt him, and he instead, we at first are led to believe he gets away and are later revealed that he was allowed to escape. And then what we see is a council meeting. Caesar knows that essentially that they are, if they stay in the forest, eventually, if a deal isn't reached, They're not going to be able to maintain safety. And so what he has done is he has sent his son and Rocket out and on a scouting mission to try and find safe harbor in California for them to move, to essentially lead the apes that are in this small, this community hidden away in the waterfall, lead them on an exodus, which is where a lot of the people, along with the gray hair, get the Moses comparisons for Caesar. And they have a meeting, and they say, look, we've gone out, we found this desert that lies beyond the mountain ridges, and if you know anything about California, it has mountains, it has desert, it has metropolises of big cities. It's a very unique state, and a very large state, and so there are multiple climates and multiple geographical and geological features to it. And so they go and they say, look, beyond the mountains here, yes, it's a long trek, but beyond the mountains here, you know, is a desert where humans would not be able to reach us. And so Caesar says, you know, we need time. We can't leave right now. Winter, who is one of a snow ape, a gorilla, a stark white gorilla, an albino gorilla, he expresses concern that, you know, we need to leave now. You know, they're coming. This attack today shows that they're getting closer and closer to our compound. Eventually, they will find us. We need to get to safety now. And, you know, Caesar disagrees. He said, look, this is going to be a mass exodus. And so, you know, we've got to take some time to prepare. So everybody goes to bed that night, and everybody's prepared for, you know, working toward this exodus. And then the colonel shows up and just starts killing people. Caesar wakes up in the dead of night, sensing something's wrong. He sees the commandos outside falling, paralining down the waterfall. And so he immediately raises the alarm. He gets his son his oldest son to stand guard and watch and stay and protect his mother, while Caesar goes to round up the patrols and some apes to fight back against the humans. And while Caesar is successful in defeating and deterring the troops from killing many of the apes, he is essentially away in another part of the compound while the colonel himself is there trying to, and he in the main room where Caesar would normally be, and of course he fires shots and kills the apes who are in the room, thinking that it's King Kong or thinking that it's Caesar. The colonel's perception is if you kill Caesar, then you can very easily capture and enslave the rest of those apes and use them to your will. Caesar hears on the radio that King Kong is dead. He knows that it's the colonel, and he runs back to the main room to find his wife and his son killed. He chases after the colonel, who cuts him loose, and he falls to the waterfall, down the waterfall into the lake, surviving. And he makes his way back up and decides that the next morning it is time to start the exodus. But he will send his people on their way, but he will not lead them because he wants vengeance. And that's where we really begin our man on a mission portion of this story. Caesar is now experiencing the kind of rage and the kind of embitterment and the kind of hatred toward man that Koba faced all of his life. And so he has decided that he wants to essentially go on a suicide mission. He wants his apes to get out to the desert so that they can find and forge their new homeland. And his opinion, his thought process is if he goes and finds the colonel and goes to meet the colonel in his compound, that it will distract the colonel long enough to give them enough space to get out to the desert. Now, of course, Maurice and Rocket and all of his other friends that he established in that animal control compound so many years ago feel for him. They are hurting with him. They agree to go with him, and they refuse to allow Caesar to leave on his own, and Caesar eventually relents. He gives his young son Cornelius, who has survived the attack in the throne room, and who is, of course, the namesake from the original trilogy. He gives him over to Lake, who was his son's lover, and ask her to look after him while he is gone. And they get on the horses and they ride. And essentially it's a man on a mission story at that point. Caesar, Maurice, and Rocket and the other gorilla, they're on this mission to find the colonel's compound. On the way, they find this small human town, and in this small human town that they come across a man building firewood. Gathering firewood for a fire in this abandoned little human compound or encampment. He's in full military garb. He looks very much like one of the colonel's men. And so he sees Maurice and the gorilla and Rocket, and he just kind of slowly puts down. He says, "I'm just going to slowly put this down," and he starts putting down the wood, and then he makes a quick motion, and he gets shot, and Maurice and Rocket and everybody turns, and they see that it's Caesar, that Caesar fired first, that Caesar did not take time to figure out what was going on or evaluate the situation, that Caesar hastily and angrily... The first place he went to was self-defense, that he shot this guy in cold blood, essentially, because the guy didn't have a gun on him. And that's our first real indication that Caesar is a changed man, that this is a revenge mission, and that he is willing to do and sacrifice and destroy anyone and anything that gets in his way from accomplishing his mission, which, you know, is a very tortured and very tried version of this character that has been so Christ-like and pious, that we're seeing his moment of temptation, his humanity, fully realized and fully setting in. As they continue to scout the area, they find Nova, or the character who will become known as Nova. She is a girl who is deaf and mute, or is not speaking, she's mute. And she communicates through sign language, which Maurice obviously very well knows. And Maurice approaches Caesar about taking her along. Caesar at first refuses, and Maurice eventually says, "I will not leave her." And so we get a no ape left behind idea. No child, no human left behind idea. And so they put a jacket on her, and they saddle her up, and they continue their long, slow march toward the encampment. Like I said, it just shows a harder edge to Caesar, and it shows that Caesar was a changed man by the events of the compound, that he really is in this just to kill the colonel, regardless of what the ramifications or implications are for his people. So as they're going through the winter in the snow-capped mountains, which again, some of this imagery, the imagery of apes on horseback, which is very much a callback to the original trilogy, and also just some of the most gorgeous imagery of the mountains of California and the apes against the beauty and the majesty of the apes against the snow in this long trudge that they're making. And along the way, they come across these men, the colonel's men, very similar to the man that was at the human compound that was the father of Noah. Nova. They're very clearly shot, and they've been very recently shot, and they discover them, and they try to communicate with them. And Caesar, once again, to show his hard edge, basically assists in the suicide of one of these men, who's already dying from his wound slowly, but Caesar puts a bullet in his head to help him ease his suffering and not carry out or prolong his days. And they find it really weird, and Caesar finds it really weird that the colonel's men, who seem to be relatively healthy and normal outside of the fact that they are struggling to speak, it calls into question the sanity of and the mindset of the colonel. But it also serves to further a plot point that, you know, the colonel is relentless and ruthless. So eventually we get to the compound where we find our next little, it's a ski lodge, and you know, very prominent ski lodges up in that part of the country in the mountains of California and Utah and Nevada, and they run across one of these that's obviously been abandoned for most of the 14 years that apes have been in charge, or the predominant species on Earth. And it's in this ski lodge concept compound that we run across Bad Ape. Bad Ape is a pure joy. Bad Ape has some of the funniest scenes of the movie. He is the comedic relief. He eases the tension. And for those of you who are excited and anticipating what Matt Reeves is going to be able to do, building a story from the ground up about the Batman, the fact that, you know, people are looking for a Nolan-esque take, right, on the Batman character from him. But this character, Bad Ape, shows that Reeves is going to be able to do something with the Batman that Nolan wasn't really able to do, which is have a truly funny, comedic character to kind of put some levity into the darkness and in the tragedy and the intensity of a film. Bad Ape is a ape that is from another part of the region, whether that, we don't know if that's Nevada, whether it's upstate California, whether it's Arizona, whether it's Oregon or Washington, we don't know. All we know is that he was in a zoo. He was a zoo ape, and the humans killed the other apes that were there before the virus spread, and that Bad Ape ran away. But that Bad Ape had progressed in knowledge and in intellect enough to where he could pick up on enough of the human's language that he could speak and that he could communicate. Matt Reeves and the producers have spoken to this idea and this notion that they put Bad Ape in the film as a way to express that there are other tribes of communicative apes around the world, and that it's not just Caesar's little clan in the San Francisco, California area, that it is far, far out there, far-reaching, and the apes are all scattered all across the globe. But Bad Ape truly does bring some of the movie's most comedic elements, just his mannerisms and the way that he's portrayed and his timing. It just really brings some true laughs, and it's something that's much needed. But he also serves a plot function, and that is he has been to what he called the Human Zoo, which is an old military compound just north of where the ski lodge is, which was once a weapons depot. And when Caesar hears this, he knows that this is more than likely where the colonel is. And so he tells his story. Bad Ape first says no. Bad Ape just wants them to stay there and be friends and just survive, which is what he's been doing for years to this point. But then Caesar tells him his story about how the colonel killed his son, and that he wants to take revenge, and that he believes that this human is with them at the Human Zoo. And so Bad Ape relents and decides that he will lead Caesar to the compound. They go to the compound and they are scouting it and they're looking at it. And it's Rocket, it's Bad Ape, it's the gorilla, and it's Caesar and Maurice, and they're there and they're looking and they're looking down at the compound. They see two horses, and the gorilla makes a comment to Caesar that you think that those are patrols, and the next thing you know, two humans are behind them trying to capture them. Now, Rocket luckily was away and in the distance with Maurice and saw the humans approaching and was able to help take care of them. But one of them sets his sights on Caesar, and the gorilla jumps on the human, killing the human. But the human in the process shoots the gorilla. And the injuries that the gorilla sustains are life-ending. And of course, he had already, Caesar had made sacrifices to protect, this ape in other movies, and so he had the opportunity with his dying act protect Caesar. And there's a very touching and very emotional moment there that moves you because you've been with this character for three movies and you've seen the development in the character grow. And there's this very moving and emotional funeral moment, basically, where Nova takes a flower, which was put into her hair by the gorilla as they were leaving the ski lodge, and he takes it out of her head and places it on his head behind his ear and kisses him. And it's just a very moving moment. And you see, again, the brilliance of the CGI and the mocap. You see him, the breath of life go out of him. And that's when Maurice has this moment of clarity. And he shows to Caesar and tries to articulate to Caesar that enough is enough. Enough people have died, enough ape lives and human lives, enough's enough. Enough bloodshed has been spilled, this needs to end. And that's when Caesar is like, yeah, you're right, this does need to end. I was selfish and foolish for bringing you with me. Y'all need to stay here, I'm going to go down to the compound. And of course, he goes down to the compound. He has had a conversation previously with Snow Ape or Winter at another military facility when they were on their way to the ski compound. He accidentally killed Snow Ape Winter in another scene, kind of just to kind of harden and put in more of a defined edge on Caesar's character as he accidentally suffocates Bad Ape, suffocates Winter from trying to keep him quiet so that the other soldiers don't find him. But Winter gives him information about the colonel and about that there are supposedly troops coming from the north to help reinforcements, and that once those reinforcements arrive, the colonel will destroy apes entirely, and that Winter turned on Caesar and was the one who gave up the location of his base because he was afraid that eventually the humans would come to get them and it would be pointless anyway. And that the gorilla who had been with Kova had told him that, that the colonel would spare his life and just make him a gorilla, make him a donkey if he turned on Caesar, and so he did. And so Caesar has his Vito Corleone, his Michael Corleone, Fredo Corleone moment where he just, I know it was you, and he accidentally kills him, but he gets the information from him. So Caesar is at the compound, he leaves Maurice and Rocket in Nova and Bad Ape on the hill, he goes down to the compound, of course he gets captured, and then we have our confrontations between Caesar and the general, between Caesar and the colonel. At this point, the colonel basically lays out his manifesto that, you know, he was glad that he caught Caesar, that he let Caesar know that they had intercepted his apes on their exodus, and so they were in captivity. He basically dresses Caesar down, mocks him, and tells him that, you know, he's now the leader, and he throws Caesar in with the rest of the apes for a little while, and then the next morning brings Caesar into his compound and has another manifesto conversation with him, where then we get to Caesar being crucified. A lot of the write-ups about this movie and about this trilogy have painted Caesar as a mosaic figure. And as I said earlier, with the decision that they made to have Caesar, to have the apes go on an exodus out to the desert and Caesar be their leader, you very much see how the mosaic allegory would work. But what they do in Apes in War is basically a Christ allegory. One of the first things that Caesar finds when he gets down to the compound is a ape graveyard of apes basically tied to his apes, his male apes mostly, tied to wooden crosses or wooden spokes that basically amount to crosses. And that the colonel basically crucified them. He didn't shoot them. He basically just starved them and put them out with the elements. And that's the same fate he tries to apply to Caesar. At first, he tries to let Caesar work with the apes and lead the apes in the building of his wall. Yes, we have a military dictator-type authoritarian leader played by Woody Harrelson to a brilliant extent. And he's building a wall. And Caesar kind of interrupts the process of building the wall, and so that's when the colonel makes the decision to try and crucify him, make an example out of him. That night after that, he brings forth he has the gorilla cut Caesar off the cross, basically, and bring him up for his meeting with Pontius Pilate, essentially. And he goes, you know, and he lays out his reasoning for why he's doing what he's doing. And we get some information that is actually pretty vital to the plot of the movie. What we learn basically in that moment is that the virus that was spread amongst humans in the original film that caused the original extinction level event has been mutating in and amongst the survivors, and that he first noticed this, the colonel first noticed this with his son, who just stopped speaking one day. And a lot of people and doctors and military doctors and such that he took to evaluate his son told him that it was just PTSD and that the war was too much for him. But slowly but surely, the doctors and the guards who were the other people, troops that were with him, they all started to not speak. And the colonel talked to the doctor about it, and the doctor had a theory that this virus was evolving, that it was mutating, and that it was rendering humans mute. And so essentially what the colonel then ordered was for all of the troops that were in his son's battalion to basically be executed. An ethnic cleansing, a purging of the ranks, and that they would kill the troops, their men, their women, and their children, and they would burn all their artifacts and establishments. The problem is when you execute an order like that, something similar to Order 66 in the Star Wars universe. The problem is occasionally there's going to be a person with a conscience. He's going to go, you know what? This is probably not the right thing to do. And that happened to the colonel. And one of his men escaped. One of the men allowed one of the infected to escape. And a few of them escaped, like the man who was in the village with his daughter that they found earlier. And like the men who they found shot. And the colonel was the one who shot them. And one of the people who, you know, was carrying out that purge allowed somebody to get away out of the goodness of his heart. He got killed for his efforts, but that guy ran to the superiors in the north and told them about what the colonel was doing. They came down to confront the colonel, and the colonel had them beheaded and left one back alive to go back to the north and tell them that if they wanted to remove him from his post, they would have to do so by force. And so the colonel reveals that, you know, he needed help building the wall, and so that's why he went after Caesar's apes, not only because he hates apes and hates the fact that they had become superior to humans, but also because he needed a workforce to help build his wall, not to keep apes out, but to keep humans out, and to stand as a line of defense for the oncoming onslaught of troops that are eventually going to come to remove him from his post. And so he goes on his rant, and at the end of it, he says, you know, I didn't intend on killing your son, but if he was going to take over your unholy, godless kingdom, then I'm glad I did it. And that causes Caesar to go to get frustrated, and he pushes Harrelson's character, the colonel, and they eventually wrangle him up, and they tie him back up to the tree, to the cross, and they pour water on him in the cold, because he thirsts for water. He asks for water, and he thirsts for water, and they just pour the water on his head, which, just in the freezing cold of the winter, makes things worse and brings him closer to pneumonia. And this is where this moment, this night after that he's been retied to the cross, and after the colonel has dictated that if he is still alive after that to shoot him, that Nova sneaks out of the watch of Bad Ape and Maurice, who have found an underground tunnel to try and help get the apes out of the compound. And she goes to Caesar. And what we have here is a moment of a restoration of faith. This is Caesar at his lowest moment, literally gasping for breath, literally laboring to survive, cold, you know, hungry, and pneumonia. He's bargained with the colonel enough that the colonel has decided to give them food and water so that they will work harder, so that they will build the wall faster, because he knows that the insurgents are coming. But in this moment where he's struggling on the cross, his Abba Father moment, Nova comes to him. And Nova comes to him while he's in the cage, and they've taken him off the cross, and they've thrown him in the cage, and Nova comes to him, and Nova brings him water, and Nova brings him food, and Nova touches his face and gives him the doll that she has carried with her entire life, since she's been alive, and as a sign of goodwill and love toward him. And Caesar, who, once again, because he sacrificed for his apes to get their food and water, his apes are back on board with him, and they make the apes together strong. And Caesar looks at the little girl, and he has his faith, a moment where his heart is kind of healed. He is reminded of the love and the compassion and the generosity of spirit that Franco showed to him all those years ago when he was just an infant, abandoned, orphaned by the death of his mother. And it restores kind of his hope, and it restores kind of his faith, and redoubles his strength and his efforts, for getting out of the situation that they're in. Rocket, in order to get Nova out or allow or provide cover for Nova to get out of the base, goes and surrenders himself. While he is in the pen, he relays the message and the information to Caesar about the underground portal, the underground tunnel, to that's a way for them to get out. And, this starts our third act of the movie, where basically it's, the colonel opens the gate, he throws Caesar out, and he tells Caesar to go back to work, but he notices the doll, he picks up the doll, and he tells the troops to take Caesar to the quarry to continue building the wall. He takes the doll and he goes back up to his office, and that we don't hear from him again for a little while after that. That night is the night that Caesar and Rocket, Maurice and Bad Ape carry forth their plan to get the apes out. It's a very interesting, very dramatic, and this is one of the things that gives me hope and interest for Reeves' Batman, is the way that they set up the dramatic ending of this movie. So the human character who is on guard gets poop flung at him. This, of course, is a callback to the Dean DeHaan situation in the Rise of the Planet of the Apes movie. They bait him in to the cage. Bad Ape opens up the hole that has been dug out underneath the ape hole. And he brings down the human with him. They knock him out or they kill him. They get his keys and they open up the gate and they escape. They get Caesar out, and then they realize that they cannot, because the water has started to fill up the underground part. So they realize that they can't escape underneath the ground, especially with the children. So they go across the way, they get the children out, and they start trying to make their escape. And it is about this time that the reinforcements show up, and the war for the Planet of the Apes, the war of humans versus humans, begins. And really, the ape role in the humans versus humans battle is simply just to provide cover and to provide an opportunity for them to escape. And it is not until they are well into the escaping that the men who are on the wall trying to fight and battle the airplanes and the aerial assault going on by the soldiers from the north realize that the apes are trying to escape, that they start trying to open fire. And some apes die. But they're trying to make their escape. At the same time, Caesar is up in the compound. He sends the apes to escape, and he again goes after the colonel. And this time he goes up to the colonel, and the colonel's men are knocking on the door because the airplanes have flown in and the bombs are going off, and they're looking for their leader. Caesar swings up to the top. He goes into the room. He finds a bunch of alcohol strung around everywhere. And what we see is the colonel lying on his bed trying to speak and can't. And what we realize is that the doll, because Nova has been infected with the virus, the virus has already mutated inside of Nova and her father, and there was blood on the doll. And so the infection, the virus was triggered inside of the colonel when he was working, touching and handling the blood-stained doll, and so it mutated inside of him, and his worst fear had come true. He was now becoming mute and subservient. And the colonel had already explained and talked to Caesar about how he had killed his own son. He had shot his own son in the head, seen the love in his eyes, and pulled the trigger because he couldn't stand for the idea of his son. His son was a member of a plague. He had a plague, and he had to be gotten rid of. And the plague had to be isolated so that humanity could survive, because the threat of that disease would eventually just lead to there being a Planet of the Apes and, you know, humans becoming completely subservient to apes without being able to communicate. So here he is in his worst nightmare. He's now also afflicted by this. And so Caesar finds him, and Caesar gets the gun. And this is where I really think you can sincerely make the case for Serkis with the acting and with the Oscar. Because the facial stuff, the facial recognition, so the way that CG motion capture works is there are dots all over your body, and you are acting, and the computer is reading your performance physically and inputting that data into the computer, and that data is that data of your performance and the way you move and the way you interact with your face and your hands and your legs and your feet is put into the computer, and then they put a CG character, put that CG skin basically on you of a CG character, and that's how you get what has happened. And so in this moment where the colonel is struggling for words, he's trying to communicate with Caesar. Caesar realizes what's going on. He picks up the gun, he points it at his head, and you can just see in Caesar's eyes and Caesar's facial expressions, the acting, the emoting. No words are spoken, but the amount of emotion, elation, and anger, and hatred, and vitriol that is in his face just tells the world of a story. He is confronted here with his temptation to be Koba, to take out his revenge, to get his moment of vengeance for what happened. And ultimately, Caesar puts the gun back on the desk and walks steps away from the colonel, because he ultimately realizes that the colonel is in his own personal hell. That there is no fate that Caesar could inflict upon him. That death would just be the thing the colonel would want. That he would be giving him a benefit, relief, by doing it. And so he decides not to. And of course, the colonel eventually grabs the gun and commits suicide. And Caesar then swings out of the building. He sees his apes being shot as they're trying to escape, and he sees a leaking propane tank, and he sees some grenades on a grenade belt, which the colonel had on his desk, and he grabs it, and he swings down, and he starts making his way toward it. The gorilla, who was Koba's friend, who was the one who strung Koba up, strung Caesar up on the cross, the one whom he interacted with the most in his trial phase, in his crucifixion phase, his persecution phase, is the one on the wall helping to load the gun and get the rocket launcher and help shoot the apes. And again, in a tribute to the CGI and the motion capture, you can see the emotion and the thought processes. Words aren't really being used, but you can see it in his face, what's going on and what he's thinking and how he's emoting as he's looking at these young apes, these baby apes, these children being shot as they're just trying to escape a war zone. And then he turns around and he sees Caesar, who has been haunted by visions of Koba, running toward the propane tank. But the other person, someone else sees that, and that is the troop, the young man, the soldier who Caesar spared at the beginning of the movie. And he takes his bow and arrow and he shoots Caesar, which delays Caesar from getting to the propane tank and throwing the grenade. And he stands there with Caesar on his knees, and he has the bow and arrow in a really dramatic, really beautifully set, and really beautifully blocked moment. And then an F-15 comes in and fires off a tomahawk and blows him away. Caesar runs from that tomahawk blast and from many more, grabs the the belt, or no, it's not a F-15 missile, it's a grenade launcher by the gorilla, who was on the wall looking again at these young apes. And he, again, like I said, with the emotion on his face, he figures out, he has a moment of repentance. And so the prodigal ape, so to speak, if you want to continue with your biblical analogy, the ape that had wandered away from Caesar, who had gone and been tempted to join the world with Koba, and who had run and hid from his judgment, thinking that it was better to serve with, be a pig in the human, for the humans, and swaddle in their filth for them, than to face the judgment of Caesar, returns by taking out the troop who was going to kill Caesar, and allowing Caesar to then blow up the wall with him on it, to prevent allow the apes to finally escape. So that happens, and Caesar is left, and Caesar is swinging, trying to walk and get away, and he's observing the damage and all the wreckage, and then he hears more sirens and more calls, and he sees a wave, a mass of white snowtrooper humanity rolling in. They roll into the depot. They see the work that their air campaign has done. They find that the colonel is dead. Their work is done. And they're all hoo-haing and roo-haing and celebrating. And then they turn and they see in this great, again, a beautifully staged shot, Caesar standing alone in his great, his this gray, older, you know, world-weary, war-weary Caesar standing in amongst the snow. And just all these snowtroopers, plaid and white, turning around and looking at Caesar and seeing him, and raising their gun to him, getting ready to kill him. And then the avalanche happens. An avalanche starts racing toward the valley. And avalanches are an occurrence that happen in the mountains from time to time. And so the avalanche comes, and Caesar runs away from it, and it's very much similar and evocative of the mist of the at the end of the first movie, and the smoke and the things that are emanating from at that point. And if you want to get down to it, it's very reminiscent too of the white smoke that had the virus in it that gave the apes their intelligence. And the avalanche comes, and Caesar has to outrun the avalanche, and it overwhelms the troops and flushes out all of the fires, and Caesar rides it out as holds onto a tree and rides out as the avalanche pours forth, and he then meets up with his other apes as they swing off, and you get this very emotional, very powerful last shot of the film. Which leaves the apes, again, a pocket of apes in this Northern California area. But we also now know that there are more apes. The Bad Ape represented a cultured group of apes who could learn and had intelligence but did not have the leadership of Caesar. So that brings us to a conversation now about where we go from here. Obviously, I love this film. This film is beautiful. It has tons of you know, allegory and subtext and things that are tremendously important and vital. There's a reading, you know, we talk about reading film as literature. This is a great chapter in the film as literature book. But where do we go from here? Future stories could pick up on other pockets of ape civilization. They're very clear at the beginning of the movie that it's 14. There are 14. 14 years have passed from the beginning of Rise of the Planet of the Apes to the beginning of war. And there's still many, many, many more years. I think 35 or 40 more years before Charlton Heston returns from the mission that he went off on in the beginning of Rise. So there's still a long way to go to get the world and the Earth to the place where we find it in the original Planet of the Apes. And whereas the X-Men franchise with their First Class trilogy, and especially with Days of Future Past, stopped trying to work their way to that original X-Men movie of 2000 and did put more bends and twists in the river that made it impossible to ever get there. The Apes trilogy has made it very possible and has paved the way for us to eventually get to the place, Earth, the way that Charlton Heston finds it when he returns at the end of the original movie. But that's a ways off. This movie is going to make a lot of money. Dawn made a lot of money. Apes made sufficient money for its August release date. It's one of the most critically acclaimed franchises in history, and with the new makeup of the Academy, I would not be surprised if it has a possibility for an Oscar campaign. Matt Reeves, as we've talked about, has been a key creative force, having directed both Dawn and War of the Planet of the Apes. And Andy Serkis is obviously a very busy man with what he's doing with Black Panther and his Jungle Book and all the other incendiary projects that he has. So the question would really be one of would Reeves be willing to return to this area, this franchise, in a couple of years after the Batman is shot and done? And Reeves has said that he would be more than happy to return to this franchise. And Serkis said he is willing to return to this franchise. And Toby Kibble, who did Koba, said he'd be more than willing to return to do more mocap. So the future of the Apes franchise looks very bright, and this creative team that they've assembled in Serkis and Kibble and the producers and Reeves and even if you wanted to bring Wyatt back, is making brilliant, textured, nuanced popcorn movies. And I think that there is a very distinct market for that. And I really think they're in a good position to continue telling these kinds of stories for years to come. And I hope that they do so going forward. So that'll about do it for our conversation about War for the Planet of the Apes. I know I've talked for a while, and this is, again, a version of the show that existed at its very embryonic stages, back when I was doing podcasts by myself on Avengers Age of Ultron and Mad Max Fury Road. And the fact of the matter is that this podcast is almost 100 episodes old. And we are very much looking forward to many, many more episodes and events to come. But the podcast format as it is now with me and Chad is working really well. And we are so honored and so thankful and so grateful and indebted not only to the people at Podomatic for supplying the service to put and post our episodes to iTunes, but also to each and every one of our listeners. Whether you just visit our page or whether you actually download the podcast or subscribe to it through iTunes, we're very grateful to our listeners in D.C., to our listeners in New Orleans and Baton Rouge and Dallas and Boston and San Jose and Wichita and all of the in New York and in Columbus and Cleveland and all the various places around the United States. But we're also indebted to our viewers and our listeners overseas and in Madrid and in London in Madrid and London and in Barcelona, in Uganda, in Beijing, in Mongolia, in in Sydney, in Melbourne, you know, in Toronto, and all of these other places where our podcast is being listened to. You know, we're small. And let's make no bones about that. We are small. But we feel like we have a very dedicated and very loyal and very gracious audience. And we hope to grow that audience as we move forward. Because we are going to come eventually to a place where we need listeners in order to validate doing this and to keep doing this. And as long as you like, and as long as you subscribe, and as long as you comment, and as long as you download, as long as we get more than 10 people listening every week, we will do this. And so far, that's been the case. Personally, I'm indebted to Chad for coming on board. I'm indebted to people like Matt Goldberg and Adam Chitwood and Jim Vegeta and Rock Cornett and Terry Schwartz. I know that I got into some issues legally with tagging and just ethically by tagging IGN in a couple of these episodes, but those guys are just so professional and so smart and funny and amazing and great at what they do. And I just feel like our podcast could reach their audience as well. And so I was trying to find ways to broaden our horizons. So we are at the point in time in our podcast where we'd like to tell you that if you like our podcast, please tell your friends about our podcast, especially if you're overseas. And I'd like to finish up this podcast by thanking Chad, by thanking Lauren Siddharth, Megan Fickle, who's now married and has a different name. I'd like to thank Madeline. I'd like to thank all of the different people, T-Bob Hebert, Jim Vegeta, all the different ones who've supported me, uplifted me, and encouraged me to keep this podcast going, because this is the highlight of my week, is getting to sit here with my boy Chad and talk for an hour and a half about movies. And I hope that it's a joy and a pleasure for you as well as it is for us. So please tell your friends about the podcast, and we will be back later in the week with a full normal episode where we talk about all the movie news of D23 and preview Comic-Con as we get into the festival season of news. D23, Comic-Con, Dragon-Con, all that kind of stuff. So for Chad Metz, I am Brian C. Wood. You can follow me on Twitter at BCWTigerFan. He is at The Metz Theory. Thank you very much, and have a pleasant evening.